Thank you very much for the invitation. I am delighted to be here, and this is my first visit outside of the United States, past the Bush generation, the Bush period. So I'm happy to be here, and I'm proud to be here as an American. So I shouldn't say that, but it's being recorded, so I thought I would. So it's official. I'm going to talk to you today about some work we're performing at UC Berkeley and at the Lawrence Berkeley Lab. And I'm going to get my laser pointer. I'm a faculty member at Cal, and I'm also a staff scientist at the Lawrence Berkeley Lab. And any of you who have visited Berkeley know that there's a very important, intimate relationship between the university and LBL. We have the wonderful benefit of working with many staff scientists who contribute a great deal, not only to our research, but to the education of our students. So it's really a wonderful place. And this will show you that there is really a strong interaction. Today what I'm going to talk about is just give you a general overview of semiconductor alloys, and then focusing then at for a particular set of alloys that are really actually really hard to make because materials are not miscible with each other, but they really show remarkable properties. Then I'm going to talk to you a little bit about what we do to synthesize these materials, really performing a technique that is different from what is usually used to grow thin films from these alloys. And I'm going to focus on two examples of materials. These are highly mismatched alloys, and these are semiconductors that are effectively a compound with a little bit of a small amount of an alloying species. And just adding that little bit of alloying species actually changes a certain optical or electrical property quite a bit. And then I'm going to continue on with the ferromagnetic semiconductors, which of course are another type of material in which the material itself is basically a semiconductor, and just by adding a little bit of a transition metal, the magnetic properties change dramatically from being, say, a diamagnet to being a ferromagnet. And then I'll summarize. So many of you, I'm sure, have seen this picture, which really has, technologically, has been extremely important. And this is a plot of band gap versus lattice constant. And it's something that for the last 30 years has dominated semiconductor science and technology. And that's because we can perform band gap engineering. We can control the size of a band gap in a semiconductor by just controlling its composition. The big challenge here is devising ways to how to grow these materials, because we can't just grow bulk crystals of each of these types of compounds. We have to form thin films of these materials. And because of that, that means that we need to find the right types of substrates onto which to synthesize these materials. And that's what this attempts to achieve, to show you what type of band gap there is depending on, say, lattice constant. So if I look at the most important system until recently, it's gallium arsenide with aluminum arsenide. And you can see that there's almost a straight vertical line that joins these two, which means that I can grow aluminum arsenide on gallium arsenide and actually form quantum wells because they have a different band gap, and therefore I can produce different types of devices. And this is done through thin film technologies. So for example, one nice experiment which I took from the additional information from when Herbert Kromer and Jack Kilby and Alfirov won the Nobel Prize. And that was really for understanding the physics of multilayered systems and what comes out of them, but making these materials at the heart. And this is a scanning electron micrograph of actually a high mobility electron transistor. And the transistor is right over here, and it looks really rough, but they're actually films grown in the vertical direction that contain different compositions and are controlled with near atomic precision. Right now, gallium nitride actually is becoming, the gallium nitride family of materials is becoming the second most important semiconductor next to silicon. And that's because it can emit light over a large range, including blue and now working towards green. And this is another case where by growing multiple layers of materials which are precisely controlled in terms of the composition, and you can generate the right band structure and also optics in order for one to produce a solid-state laser. So that's another example of using bandgap engineering to create devices that are really ubiquitous. For example, traffic signals, right? Before they used to be green light bulbs, now they're all these little green dots. Those are all light-emitting diodes made from indium gallium nitride-based material. And of course, a very important area now is photovoltaics, solar energy. And this is a solar cell that has record efficiency of around 41%. And that comes from the Fraunhofer Institute for Solar Energy in Freiburg. And you can see, you won't see the layers here right now, but this material consists of three types of materials. There's a p-n junction in this material, gallium indium phosphide. There's a p-n junction in gallium indium arsenide, and then there's a p-n junction in germanium. And by stacking these materials together, you can achieve this high efficiency. This would not be achievable if you couldn't control the alloy composition in order for you to be able to grow with the same lattice, almost the same lattice constant, this structure. If you take a look at this system, the solar cell, you find that, in fact, it's not just a single material you're growing. You're actually growing, for example, in this case, you're growing you have gallium arsenide here, you get indium gallium phosphide, aluminum gallium arsenide, and then you get to the first, the intermediate cell, and you see that the active region is this indium gallium arsenide, but still you have to grow different types of materials to form this junction. So you're actually growing many layers to form these three p-n junctions so they can have the right electrical transport through the whole device, and you can actually grow it physically, being able to grow it with a reduced density of defects so that you won't lose the charge that you're generating. Thin film epitaxy really exists right now in two important flavors. That's molecular beam epitaxy and a form of chemical vapor deposition. And the important thing about thin film epitaxy that allows us to create these materials that we just don't find that we can grow in the bulk is that the way the materials are synthesized, that process is mediated by a surface. And what that means is that mass can move more readily on a surface than it can in the bulk material. So in the case of thin films, we have this surface that is mediating the surface diffusion, incorporation of these atoms that are on the surface onto a lattice. There's also, of course, re-evaporation. And there's surface aggregation to nucleate a new phase of material. So all the surface diffusion that happens on a surface can happen with smaller energy barriers, and therefore at lower temperatures, and therefore one can control layer by layer how materials are synthesized, compared to bulk, which requires mass transport through a bulk material, which is orders of magnitude slower than it is at the growth temperatures than it would be on a thin film. There's another type of I've showed you these types of materials that are used ubiquitously in various electronics technologies, but these aren't the only types of materials that might be desirable. There are other types of compounds that would be desirable to combine, but they're not sufficiently miscible. And the reason why they're interesting is because they display a tremendous changes in a property just by a small change in composition. And I point to you the material system, for example, gallium nitride, which has a band gap of 3.4 eV, and gallium arsenide. And you can see that, of course, there's an enormous change in lattice constant. So it's basically impossible to grow a film of gallium nitride directly on a gallium arsenide substrate. But what you can see is that if I add a little bit of arsenic to gallium nitride, I can generate a large change in band gap, because it doesn't take much material to lead to such a change in band gap, that energy gap between the conduction band and valence band. And this is really the most dramatic system, but there are many other systems. If you look at gallium antimonide and gallium nitride, you see this big curve in how the band gap behaves as a function of a lattice constant, and really that means composition. And this is called giant band gap bowing. It's not a linear combination of the two band gaps that one observes. Instead, it's a bowing of that band gap as a function of lattice constant, which really translates into composition. This is a case of, you look at just the close to the gallium arsenide side of it, you find that if you add a little bit of nitrogen, if I replace 5% of the arsenic atoms with nitrogen, just 5%, 5 out of 100, I can change the band gap of that material by 1/2 of an electron volt, which is a third of the total band gap, a little bit more than a third of the total band gap of this material. I mean, that's a really remarkable effect. If I look at these other materials I had talked about, where one can gradually alloy the two endpoint compounds, it would take a lot more alloying to produce that type of change. Here, I almost keep the same material, gallium arsenide, and then I can change the band gap by a significant amount. The reason why this happened is because these classes of materials consist of a species like nitrogen that is much more electronegative than the species that it is substituting. So nitrogen is much more electronegative than arsenic. So when I put a nitrogen impurity into gallium arsenide, it forms a level inside the semiconductor, an electronic level. And this electronic level interacts with the conduction band of the material. And the conduction band then restructures electronically. And I effectively form a new band structure in this material. So this large band gap in material, this large change in band gap of this material really refers to a change in the conduction band, because that local energy level related to nitrogen mixes with the conduction band, and this restructuring leads to a new band structure that looks like this, and then this band gap is significantly reduced. So this being able to mismatch, produce materials that have this mismatch feat component in the lattice is very important. You know, nitrogen being much more electronegative than arsenic. So the fact that these materials can be synthesized by just changing the composition a little bit really opens new opportunities for finding other ways to realize these materials, because after all, a molecular beam epitaxy system is not too cheap. And normally, these types of systems, they are dedicated for a specific type of material synthesis. So what we've endeavored to perform is find a different way to create these materials in which we can do materials, perform materials exploration by injecting, say, the nitrogen atoms into a gallium arsenide, and then finding subsequent processing techniques to heal the crystal, because that injection through implantation causes damage, and then create this film. And that's what we do. We use ion implantation, and then I'll talk about it a little bit later. We use excimer laser pulses to actually regrow this single crystal film into a single crystal film that now has that ion, that species that was implanted into the system. So ion implantation is something that's very interesting in that you can inject any species into a substrate, and then the job of us as a material scientist is to find out how can we incorporate that species that we have implanted into the right position, right location in the crystalline lattice of the material. And that's where doing post-implantation processing is important. And the part that we work on is in right over here in post-laser melting. And this just gives you a rough time scale in terms of what time frame does one use to heal this crystal. So normally when you put a crystal in a furnace and you want to anneal it for some reason, that can be in the many minutes to even hours or days. And that leads to a certain, I would say, equilibrium-like behavior, because you give your material enough time for bulk diffusion to take place. So it happens at a high temperature and a long duration. So in the 80s, this process of rapid thermal annealing, which means just heating something to a high temperature very quickly and then quenching that sample, was developed. And that was found to be a very effective way to implant impurities into a crystal and then heal the crystal, remove that implantation damage. But even this process is sometimes not fast enough to try to create, to overcome this miscibility gap between two materials. You have to combine these materials so quickly so that the material, that the individual species do not have time to form the phases, that the equilibrium phases that they want to form. And sometimes seconds is simply not enough. So what you can do is you can use a laser to actually perform that same type of process in a sub-microsecond time scale. So how do we do this? We Take, for example, in this case, let's say I want to implant nitrogen here. So I don't have manganese. Let's avoid this piece and let's talk about the red one. So I want to do N. I implant manganese ions into material. So I just accelerate a beam of ions onto a surface, and they get implanted into it. And then these ions, they destroy the lattice near the surface. And what I do then is I can just take a laser, a high-powered laser, an excimer laser, that in which the laser light will get absorbed very quickly right near the surface, and then all that energy from that laser is going to be dissipated through the crystal, and what it'll do, it'll lead to the melting of that surface region. Once that happens, then the whole implanted region gets melted, and you can imagine a liquid consisting of arsenic, gallium, and nitrogen. And I'll tell you why I have manganese here, because that's what another species we do. And what happens is that once the material begins to cool down, solidification happens. You're solidifying the material from that liquid-solid interface out towards the surface. And as you're doing that, you're incorporating that implanted species very quickly in the time scale of less than a microsecond, and you form that new phase. Okay? If I were to do this slowly, I would form phases of gallium nitride and phases of gallium arsenide. I would not form gallium nitride arsenide. One way to monitor this is by actually measuring the reflectivity of the sample. And this was one of actually when this was first performed 30-something years ago, there was not a clear indication of whether or not the film was actually melting. And one of the ways that it was shown unequivocally is that the reflectivity of the material was measured as the process was taking place. And you can see that there's a significant change in reflectivity once the sample melts, and then it remains at this point, and then when the sample solidifies, then reflectivity change is removed. And therefore, we know that this is the duration of the melt in this material. So it's really sub-microsecond pulse duration. And we've performed this in many types of materials, and I think the important thing to think about this is like we're doing solidification in a microsecond. And that allows us to beat our kinetic limit of and thermodynamic limits of forming that want to form thermal phases that are in thermal equilibrium. Instead, we kind of freeze everything into place and therefore are able to form these non-equilibrium phases. So let's take a look at what happens to this gallium nitride arsenide material when you do that. If I just take nitrogen implantation, and then I anneal it by thermal means, rapid thermal annealing, so say 900 degrees for 20 seconds or something like that. What happens is that I form some gallium nitride arsenide, but I don't incorporate the nitrogen effectively, because the nitrogen has time to actually find other nitrogen atoms, and actually form N2. So if I look at the atomic scale image of how that film looks, I can find little bubbles inside the material. I don't find the nitrogen, but I find the shape of a bubble in the material that has to do with nitrogen collecting there and not incorporating into the crystal. And so what we see, first of all, is that we can change the band gap by just doing this process by a little bit, but we're not so successful. Because, again, rapid thermal annealing is not fast enough to trap all the nitrogen. When you add this laser annealing process, laser melting process, then you are much more effective. And you can see here a plot of how the band gap changes as a function of nitrogen. And the red refers to the use of laser, using this post-laser melting process. And you can see that these numbers reflect what fraction of implanted nitrogen is actually incorporated into the crystal. So in this case, we're incorporating about 4 out of 10 nitrogen atoms into that lattice. In a comparable case for using rapid thermal annealing, you're not incorporating nearly as much because it's not fast enough. You're not solute trapping the nitrogen into its place. In fact, I should tell you that if you do this melting process too quickly, then you can't even crystallize the film. The film will just solidify as an amorphous layer because you're not giving even the host atoms enough time to rearrange themselves to form to extend that crystal structure that comes from that liquid-solid interface. Now, if you perform transmission electron microscopy and see exactly what's going on in this crystal, what you find is that, in fact, there are a lot of defects that remain in this material. And this is near the boundary between, this is called end-of-range damage. This is where you find the maximum amount of damage due to the ion implantation process. And you can see that seeing all these features in a crystal is bad. Right? These are defects, and these are dislocations inside, dislocation loops inside these materials. If you look at the material that was laser melted, what you find is that I've indicated here with this arrow, this is the line down to which the film was melted. So if I don't melt through the system, I still have these large defects. But if the film melts, then you can get this epitaxial regrowth, and you extend the crystalline structure from the substrate into the crystal, and you get really very beautiful regrowth at the, and this is right near the interface. And pulse laser melting is very well known for generating materials that have, say, point defects that we wouldn't detect by this microscopy technique. But it's well known for not generating extended defects like dislocations, which are defects that you would see much more clearly. So that's something that we would expect. The nice thing about it is the fact that you can now still incorporate a much larger fraction of the nitrogen atoms. So that's one example. But there are other actually very interesting examples, because what if maybe there are materials out there that have not been synthesized by thin film processes because, not just because people haven't thought about it, but just because they're really hard to synthesize by thin film processes, and there's not the will to explore and take that risk to try it. So this is a very easy process to say, well, let's see if it works. And one can choose a very nice types of systems that one has the expectation will be very interesting based on this restructuring of the conduction band, for example. So here's a case where we have materials. These are actually chalcogenides. These are 2,6 compounds. And we're going to try to add oxygen, because oxygen, again, has a much higher electronegativity than the group 6 species that we're going to try to replace. So if you look here at materials like manganese telluride, what you see is that the oxygen level that forms by adding oxygen into this material is slightly below the conduction band edge, which is what this indicates. These indicate the valence band edge. So for example, if I were to be able to introduce oxygen into, say, manganese telluride, then I would form an energy level in the dilute limit just below the conduction band edge. If I add enough of these oxygen, then there's a new restructuring of that conduction band that will lead not only to a reduction in the band gap, right? So from here to here, right? So you see this is larger than this. But it also leads to the formation of an entirely different type of conduction band structure. And in this case, what we find is that we end up with a structure that includes an impurity band within that band gap. It's an oxygen impurity band, in fact. But this oxygen is very unique because it doesn't behave like a regular impurity. It doesn't provide mobile charge to this material, so it doesn't affect its conduction. It restructures that conduction band edge. And why would that be interesting? Well, that might be interesting for solar cells, for example. So you can imagine, I mentioned to you that these multi-junction cells the one I showed you has 3 p-n junctions. And each p-n junction absorbs a different part of the spectrum of the sun. So the more junctions I have, in principle, the more efficiently I can absorb sunlight. And that's how 41% conversion efficiency has been achieved, which I think is pretty astonishing when you think about, for every 100 photons you get, 40 you get charge of 40 units of charge back. I mean, that's pretty amazing for this light to electron conversion. So this is one way of doing it, but it's very complex, as we showed you. Imagine now if you had one material where you can generate multiple transitions that can absorb this in different parts of the solar spectrum. That's what this intermediate band would do, because you would start from the valence band, and then you can absorb to this intermediate band, and then you can absorb from that intermediate band to the conduction band, and then you can absorb directly from the valence band to that higher conduction band, right? So you would take one material and worry about just growing one type of material, and then create multiple absorption possibilities to more efficiently absorb light. And this has been proposed for about 10 years, but it has not really been realized yet. So what we did is we implanted oxygen into zinc manganese tellurite, and then we saw how the band gap changed. And what we did is we measured transitions from holes from the valence band to the intermediate band, and then to the higher line edge, band edge, and then we measured them as a function of oxygen concentration. And what you see is that as you add more oxygen, this intermediate band shifts to lower energy compared to the isolated oxygen level. And the other band, the higher line conduction band, shifted to higher energy. So you can imagine that there is a certain composition in which the transition from, say, a valence band down here up to this intermediate band, and then up to this energy level, and absorption between these two energy levels would optimize the absorption of the sunlight, right? That's what we're looking for. Okay, so let's see how that would work. And so here I show you, this is exactly the type of structure that we have for this zinc telluride, manganese telluride oxide, and zinc telluride oxide actually is the same. So we would absorb this, we absorb this to the intermediate band, and then we absorb between the intermediate band and the conduction band edge. And in fact, there's a scientist from Spain, Antonio Luque, who actually computed what type of solar energy conversion efficiency one would have if one had this multi-level system. And of course, there are some approximation made that we have not solved technically. For example, that we can populate this level and the electrons remain there for a long enough time to then absorb another photon and then detect the electron, detect that charge that moves here. The other thing we have to do is we can't just detect the electrons directly that are excited here, because then that means we basically short anything that happens above in terms of energy. So we have to block the conduction of that band. So there are a lot of technical issues, but just if you just look at having a multi-band system like this, then you can start calculating efficiency, and you can, for say 5% oxygen that forms separation, this separation and this separation here, that's what these numbers indicate, you can get up to potentially 55% solar energy conversion efficiency, which is remarkable, because if you look at silicon, the thermodynamic limit for efficiency for silicon is around 30%. And right now, the best solar cells for silicon operate at in the 24%-ish type of range. And that's really actually remarkable. I think anything that gives you 1 in 4 back is in terms of solar energy conversion, it's a remarkable achievement. So, but imagine now being able to, in one material, you grow one type of film, and then you actually double the type of solar energy conversion. So that's one area that we worked on synthesizing these materials, and my colleagues at the Lawrence Berkeley Lab actually are working and trying to make a solar cell out of this, and actually also this look for other types of materials that might show this type of intermediate band structure. And two of them are gallium arsenide nitride phosphide, which actually can be grown by MBE, and then there's aluminum gallium arsenide nitride, which hopefully in the near future we hope to start growing and see if we can generate this intermediate band by a thin film technique, and then process and realize a high efficiency solar cell. Okay. So the next topic I'm going to talk about, I'm going to switch gears now and talk to you a little bit about the work that my group does, is engaged more in, more intimately in, and that's looking at ferromagnetic semiconductors. Because this is, again, another classic case in which this is a canonical system, the most important example of how adding a transition metal to a semiconductor makes that semiconductor ferromagnetic. And that was discovered, this material was discovered about 12 years ago, and then there has been intense interest in trying to realize this material into a ferromagnet at room temperature, and that's been the big limit, and I'm not going to get into that. What I want to emphasize is that this is simply another case where replacing a small fraction of the host atoms by a really different species leads to an enormous change in property, right? So I replace 5% of gallium atoms with manganese, and I convert that material into a ferromagnet. So we've used this ion implantation pulse laser melting process to realize these materials, because it's very well known that, in fact, to grow these materials by thin film techniques is extremely challenging. And that's because if you look at what type of phases you form, depending on the growth temperature of a material and the amount of manganese you want to introduce, it turns out that there's only one very special zone where one achieves very high quality material. That's because you're fighting thermodynamics. You're fighting, these materials want to form other phases that are that's not basically the phase that you're interested in, that one is interested in investigating to understand carrier-mediated ferromagnetism. So this is a very classic picture, and as growers, what we want to do is really work in this range. This is where you get the best material. If we go too hot, we form a different type of material. If we go too low, the material doesn't grow well at all, period, because there's not enough surface diffusion to allow the film to grow up epitaxially. The other thing I should say about these materials is that there is a very close connection between the electrical behavior and the magnetic behavior. Because that's because the mobile charge in the material, the holes, they actually mediate the ferromagnetism among the manganese impurities. So this is a typical type of behavior that you'll expect, and this is material that we formed by this implantation. And one of the curious properties is that the resistivity increases as we decrease the temperature and peaks right where the Curie temperature is, where this critical temperature below which the material is ferromagnetic. And so this is a very typical signature of these types of materials. And you can see that if I measure the magnetization as a function of temperature, I see that it's a ferromagnetic below about 110 Kelvin, which is typically what you see in these types of materials. This is an electron micrograph where we do in cross-section, we try to look for, to see, well, how does the material look? Well, it turns out that the material looks really, really well just below the surface. So we get excellent crystalline regrowth below the surface. But right at the surface, you see this little dimple here, there's a little bit of damage right at that surface. And that's because we are, even for these sub-microsecond timescales, we can't trap all the manganese. So we push some of that manganese forward as the solid-liquid interface moves towards the surface. And also, we release some of that the arsenic from the film, because the arsenic has a much higher vapor pressure. So it wants to evaporate more readily than the gallium, for example. So that leads to a little bit of surface decomposition near the surface. But we've investigated this. We can keep track of it and know that it doesn't affect the properties that we are interested in observing. There are some interesting processing curiosities about this technique, is that we can use, because the laser pulse is a way that we use to introduce energy into the system, that means if we control how much energy we introduce by the energy fluence of the pulse, we can actually control some properties. So this is a case that shows this critical Curie temperature as a function of fluence, and you can see that the lower the energy, the higher this Curie temperature, right? So, and that's because this liquid can solidify more quickly, and I can solute trap more effectively the manganese impurities. However, if you go too low, what happens is that there's not enough energy to actually regrow into that film into a single crystal. So the Curie temperature goes way down. So there's a critical energy that I need above which then the film regrows. And I don't want to dump too much energy so that I don't let, I can keep this frozen, these atoms frozen in the location that I want, which is for having them substitute the gallium. The other thing you can see is that if I choose one energy fluence or the other, because I'm controlling the amount of manganese that is incorporated, I can also control the Curie temperature. So I can implant in the same way, and I just change the energy fluence, and I get a different property. We've also explored other materials, and this is gallium manganese phosphide, as we're exploring to see, well, what are the Curie temperatures associated with other materials. And this is gallium manganese phosphide. And We are interested in this because there are predictions that this will have room temperature ferromagnetism. So, and this has not been synthesized as a single crystal before. So we're doing materials exploration. We can use this very simple technique to explore different types of materials. And here what you find is that, in fact, this Curie temperature still is very low. It's below, in this case, it's below liquid nitrogen temperatures. So we don't get that boost in TC. But I think it's very important for us to be able to explore whether or not these theories that are predicting a certain type of behavior are really to validate them, right? And so if the experiment is not there, then how do you know if the predictive power of the model is valid? And that's what we do. So hopefully our colleagues in theory will then adjust their picture and help us then feedback to us, tell us what we really should be doing better in order to improve the performance of the materials. And this is just then a plot of Curie temperature versus amount of manganese. And you can see that we've plotted out already for this new material system what the dependence of Curie temperature as a function of composition is. And hopefully then our theorist colleagues can go out and make the calculation and tell us, well, don't try gallium phosphide, try this other system that'll work better. And that's what we're waiting for. Okay, so another thing we can do is the thing about lasers is that you can focus them. The thing about ion beams is that you can focus them. And there's actually this very beautiful tool called a focused ion beam, what's called a focused ion beam. And it's a machine that is used to focus gallium ions, and you can do many things. You can create focus them to a very small spot and create very small structures by literally sputtering away, creating craters in the material just because the ion from the gallium ion bombardment. So one of the things that we have thought about doing is, well, if we take this material, gallium nitride arsenide, and we bombard part of the material with gallium lines, what happens is that if we then heat up this material, the nitrogen will no longer reincorporate into the lattice. Because we know that if we heat up by rapid thermal annealing, the nitrogen just doesn't want to go into the crystal. So I can literally locally remove nitrogen from that area, and then I can locally modulate the conduction band. And if I have electrons, then in principle, I can have a well that is many, many KT deep, even at room temperature. So that's something that we've explored. And we just take a focused ion beam, and we irradiate lines. And then what we see here in the microscopy is that this is the type of damage that you get right here. And this is for a higher dose right here. Unfortunately, it looks a little bit dark. What happens is that when we rapid thermal anneal this, because we're very close to the surface, we don't see defects. And so one of the keys is that we need to mark ahead of time, where do I need to look for in my sample to see where if the annealing worked, and then look in the microscope and see, well, yes, I don't see any dislocations or any line defects right here. So I can, in principle, take this process and now make structures of quantum wire. You can think of like quantum wires, quantum dots, these types of things. And a colleague of mine at Harvard, Mike Aziz, we've worked on this a little bit, and they have really done more work on this. And what they do is that they actually locally implant nitrogen and then see if they can see that band gap change locally. And so what they do is they perform they use scanning tunneling microscopy to form this technique of ballistic electron emission microscopy to probe basically the band structure in this material. And what they see is that you do get a decrease, although not very reliably, but you do get a decrease in this band gap locally right here by just locally implanting the material. So now you can imagine, you can do band gap engineering on a surface, because all you do is change that composition every so slightly, and then the material will change because of that band gap restructuring of the conduction band. One thing we have done at Berkeley is we pattern a surface, and then we locally implant manganese. So what I do is I'm going to do a Hall effect, so I'm going to implant a Hall effect shape of manganese into the gallium arsenide. So in this case, I have only manganese here, and I have no manganese here because I covered it before implantation, by masked it, and then I can measure properties like this peak in the TC. And you can see that you get exactly what you would expect from a bulk material simply by locally implanting it. And you get something else called this, that is another signature, transport signature of this material, which is this anomalous Hall effect. Normally, Hall effect should be linear, but it has this big step structure. That's because of an anomalous Hall term, which it got. It should be over here somewhere, the extra anomalous Hall term. So you can locally imagine, you can create a little ferromagnet inside a semiconductor. And I can create now, I can literally create different types of little ferromagnets and patterns inside these materials. There are a lot of other ways that one can use lasers to affect materials. This is my colleague in the mechanical engineering department. What he does, he couples lasers to a scanning probe tip, and then he uses the near field emission from that tip to literally carve out structures. And this is the case of making an 11 nanometer line, cutting out an 11 nanometer trench out of gold. Okay, and this is his lab, laser thermal lab, UCB. So he can do that down to 11 nanometers just by taking a film and drawing a line with the laser, and you're just literally ablating away the material by so much energy. One part that we're working in at Berkeley with my colleagues at LBL, Eugene Haller and Daryl Sean, is that we're looking how can we use pulse lasers to change the properties of nanocrystals. So these are germanium tin nanocrystals that are made by implanting germanium and tin into silicon dioxide. Then you heat it up, right? And what you get is that you get lobes of, because the material, the germanium and tin do not want to form a single phase, so they phase separate. And so you have a little lobe, a small lobe, consisting of tin, mostly, and then another part consisting of germanium. If you shine a laser, what happens is that you melt these nanocrystals, right? And they solidify very quickly because only the nanocrystals absorb the laser radiation. And what happens is that the materials, they mix, but they don't have time to phase separate again. It turns out that these materials, these are amorphous. So we actually haven't, they didn't crystallize as a single crystal. They just mixed, but they didn't crystallize. So if you anneal this again, then you might imagine that you might form a different type of structure. For example, a tin shell around a germanium core. And actually, that's what they're pursuing right now. And they have gotten some promising results of creating these core shell nanocrystal structures. So that's just one more example. I'm going to conclude with one final example, is kind of using lasers to do some defect engineering in perhaps what I think is an interesting way for looking at ferromagnetic semiconductors. What we do is we're going to create a defect that passivates the ferromagnetic activity of the manganese and gallium arsenide, and then we're going to locally remove that defect with a laser, with a focus laser. The way to do that is by adding hydrogen, because hydrogen, when it attaches to a manganese atom, it passivates the electrical activity of that manganese atom. And because we need the holes from these manganese acceptors in the material, that mobile charge, to mediate ferromagnetism, we actually quench the ferromagnetism in the material. And that's very well known now. And what you see is that you start a material that has a Curie temperature around 100 Kelvin. If you hydrogenate it in a hydrogen plasma, then the ferromagnetism goes away. And then if you anneal it again at a reasonably low temperature, then the magnetism goes back. If you look at the resistivity, it does the same thing. You start out with the red, you hydrogenate, that means you remove the dopant from the material. You remove the impurity that's providing mobile charge to the valence band, and so it becomes very resistive. And if you anneal it, you get that you get back the activity of the manganese. So now what are we going to do with the laser? Well, we're going to take a laser, we're going to focus it, and then we're going to start drawing dots, lines, Hall bars, things like that, and measure what their properties are. So the first thing we do is we try to make sure that the laser actually works in general. So we take a large laser spot, and we anneal the entire material. So we're not going to melt it. We're just going to heat it up enough so that we allow the hydrogen to get away from the manganese. And so far what we find is that we can do that with, I would say, 60% success, in that the Curie temperature we get back is 60 Kelvin. We don't get 100 Kelvin, we get 60 Kelvin. And we're working right now to understand, well, what type of defect might form that leads to this not full activation of the manganese. But still, it's reasonably robust. We can measure many properties that we expect to see, like anomalous Hall. And we could even see the same types of behavior, a recovery of the resistivity. It goes up, and then as soon as you shine the laser with sufficient energy fluence, you lower that resistivity again. So we can do this with femtosecond lasers. It turns out that femtosecond lasers are better because they heat the sample for less amount of time, so that thermal diffusion that could smear out the effect of the focus laser is minimized. So here you can see that we focus a spot down to 1 micron, and then we create a line just by scanning that laser across the sample. This is a conductance atomic force micrograph, and that just shows you the change in conductivity. So blue means large conductivity, white means not so large. If you look at the accompanying AFM image, atomic force micrograph, which measures topography, you can't recognize that you've activated the manganese, because the crystal itself is the same. All you're doing is removing a little bit of hydrogen that's located in a place that's really hard to find anyway when you look at just the crystal structure. So when you look at taking this and looking at how small can you go, well, you know, just by focusing this laser by 50 times, you can actually form dots that are on the order of about 300 to 400 nanometers. So you can imagine doing near field, using near field optics, and then to even achieve even a higher resolution. And that's something we're looking into. The properties are pretty remarkable. I mean, you draw this line, and you get exactly the types of things that you see in other materials. You get the anomalous Hall term. You get this large dip in the magnetoresistance that has to do with the fact that coincides with the TC. And so the TC is around 50 Kelvin. So if you use a nanosecond laser or a femtosecond laser, you get the same TC. So there's something fundamental interaction that's going on inside the material. We draw a Hall bar, right? That's how we get this. And we can then measure this resistance, and we can measure the Hall resistance. So if you send current here and measure voltage here, that's a Hall resistance. If you send current here and measure the voltage here, that's the longitudinal resistance. And then we can apply a magnetic field, and we can see how the resistance changes as a function of the direction of the magnetic field. And you see that there's a hysteresis there. And the difference between these two peaks corresponds to basically the width of a hysteresis loop, because the scattering just peaks right where you hit the course of field, more or less. So this is a way of actually measuring what the course of field is in a material using the electrical behavior. So with that, I have one more example. So one of the things we want to do is actually do something practical. Can I spin inject, can I control now, I have a certain ferromagnet here with a certain coercivity. I have another ferromagnet with a certain coercivity here. And can I spin inject through a non-ferromagnetic region and get a certain resistance depending on whether or not the magnetization of that pad, that electrical pad, and the drain is in one magnetization orientation or another, right? So the first thing to do is to be able to create a pattern of two ferromagnets that are separated. So what we do is we scan again, but then we shutter for a limited amount of time and see how that separation happens. Now, this is not magnetism. This is just looking at electrical behavior. And what you see is that if you shutter long enough, you start really separating the two regions that would be ferromagnetic. However, there's a region probably around here in which there's a good chance that there's enough electrical conduction to not see much of a difference, but you haven't activated enough manganese to create a ferromagnet within this gap. So that's sort of the area we're looking for, in which we would have not a big difference in resistance, this impedance matching, in this whole region, but we can separate the ferromagnetic property here from the ferromagnetic property here and see if electrons that are spin polarized can move through that junction, whether depending on the magnetization orientation of each of these fingers here. Of course, the key is this gap. There's a gap here that would need to be controlled with super high precision, probably 10 nanometers, would you say, Ken? And that's really a huge challenge. But this is a large beam. We could probably go to smaller beams and then see if we can get it even closer. So with that, I just want to summarize quickly. I hope that you can you agree with me that implant ion beams and photon beams, they can be used to explore a lot of different types of semiconductor alloys, especially ones that show a significant change in property with a small change in composition. I think that's a really key component to understanding these materials. And I think you'll find as we go exploring more and more materials, you'll find that more of these materials that we explore that are interesting are going to be more difficult to synthesize in a stable form. So we're going to have to search for these kinetically limited processes that will help us overcome what nature doesn't want to give us automatically. So thank you very much, and I'll end with my collaborators.